This is Radio Times and WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscawane. And here with us in studio are Lisa Scottolini and Francesca Saratella, co-authors of their latest collaboration, Have a Nice Guilt Trip, a fifth collection of essays called from their column in The Inquirer called Chick Wit, and they are a mother-daughter team, as many of you know. Welcome to the show.
Oh, we're so happy to be here, Mary.
Yes, thank you.
This promises to be a lot of fun, although, you know, we're going to start off on a somber note because, as many of your fans know, a couple of months ago, Mother Mary passed away, and we do extend our condolences here at Radio Times. I obviously never knew her, but, you know, through your columns, you really feel you get to know her. In a way, Lisa.
Well, that's lovely of you, and thank you so much. I feel so honored that, you know, that you said that. Listen, we view this as a celebration of her life, and the way I think of it is, you know, it's a real tribute to the power of books, because I really believe in writing the truth, whether it's in fiction or nonfiction. Ironically, you're writing an emotional truth, and we wrote how she really was, and so the people wrote us and said, wow, I don't have a Mother Mary, but I have a Mother Bertha, or I have a Mother Sadie, or I have a Mother Judy. And they, because we wrote it specifically and true, people extrapolated to their own life, and that is the power of the printed word. So thank you for it, and we feel very honored and grateful, and we rejoice in knowing her and loving her and still having her with us in
sure.
a way.
Sure. Francesca, I mean, how are you doing is kind of a goofy question with something like this. I think how are you adjusting is more like it.
It is an adjustment. I mean, it takes time to process that she's gone, but in so many ways it's hard to process because she doesn't feel gone to me. I still remember so many of the times she made me laugh. Even at the very end, she kept her spirits and her sense of humor up, and I'm so grateful that we got to share these wonderful stories about her because she was a character. I mean, and she loved that we wrote about her. She loved that people knew about her. I mean, she was a star long before we gave her a stage. She was the youngest of 19 and never got the attention probably that she really deserved. Uh-huh. And she knew she deserved it. So I'm just so grateful that we have these stories out there. And of course, their memories I'll never forget. But now I even have the book as a keepsake for myself. So it's great.
And it's interesting because, you know, this book is full of stories of hers. And we were prepared that we were going to have to go out and talk about this. And the interesting thing, and it's sort of meta, is that we made our mother a character.
Yes.
But we also made her real. And she was real. And so it's a very interesting, because I said, boy, when I realized that she was actually going to pass, and it was about 3 weeks before her passing, I said, I've got to write a column because I have to let people know that. And how weird that is, but also how lovely that is and how grateful that is. And the truth is, I don't know, since I walk around in a little bit of a world where I believe that we are all of us connected.
Sure.
In a way, this isn't any different. We feel the loss of everyone and we feel the birth of everyone. And it's just very, I don't know, I'm feeling very estrogen filled right now. Oh. What can I do?
Well put. Well, you know, when you wrote of Mother Mary, you know, she's definitely a character. You poked at her gently.
Of course.
What did she think of all that?
She absolutely loved it. Honestly,
I know you
she
alluded
loved it.
To that. She didn't mind.
Whether it was notoriety or fame, she didn't care. She loved it. And I mean, we learned our sense of humor from her. She poked at us. We poked back. I mean, it was just, she reveled in it. When we would sometimes have a big book club party, we have book clubs over to our house, or sometimes we would take her to signings, she would never miss the book club party. She'd go, I'm not sure I can come up for Christmas, but I'm coming up for the book club party. Because she loved to meet people and to talk. I mean, she was a wonderful storyteller herself and had plenty of embarrassing stories about us. So I really feel like it was keeping in a tradition that she began.
And she never complained.
Oh, are you kidding? I'll tell you a brief story about the time she complained. Mm-hmm. She complained because, you know, the book is Have a Nice Guilt Trip. Mm-hmm. And it has stories about her and it pictures of her, right? But it's compiled from our Philadelphia Inquirer columns, although we write for it originally. So we're clear on that. One day, Philadelphia Magazine, in its infinite wisdom, came out with its best and worst of Philly awards. And it said that Chick Wit was the worst column in the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Oh, dear.
Now, listen, I'm bulletproof at this point. I've been in this business 20 years. Uh-huh. So I looked at that and I was like, well, I had a few choice words, but it didn't really bother me. But I called her and told her. And she was like, I want to see that in the magazine. I actually had to go buy the magazine to prove to her that I was in it for Worst Columnist. And she looked at it and she said, but they didn't mention me.
Oh, that's funny.
Right? She loved it. Take our word for it. She
Perfect.
Loved it.
Well, I'm sure we have a lot of your fans listening right now, so let me give the telephone number out. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Our guests are Lisa Scottolini and Francesca Saratella, and they've written a new book called Have a Nice Guilt Trip, and guilt is a central theme of this book. Do women buy into guilt more than men do you think?
Unfortunately, I think sometimes we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of times we feel guilty. We feel guilty even just to ourselves. I feel guilty I ate that. I feel guilty I didn't call that. You know, it's certainly it's essential with, I feel like, mothers. It's the muscle behind love, guilt. You know, that's what makes you do stuff because they're going to break your knees otherwise. The guilt will.
That's how you get your kids to do stuff, right?
You know what? Honestly, I think what happens as you get older, and I just turned 59 last week, you start to embrace the things about you that suck. You just decide that they're virtues. And so if you're guilt-ridden, you know, I sort of key off what Francesca said. Sometimes I go, you know, I must tell you this, that when I look across the board in the world, I see a lot of people who aren't guilty enough.
Yeah.
Anthony Weiner, Congress, right? Could we, the Kardashians, totally. Like, there are lists of people who are like, you want to say, have you no shame, sir? So those of us who are carry our burden of guilt and shame with aplomb, wish there were more of it to go around. So I'm not going to apologize
for
it.
So it builds character is what you're saying.
It does. And also, as mothers, you know, you learn to inflict guilt. It's really one of the few weapons you have in your quiver.
But don't you wish you could do sometimes what men, not all men, of course, but some men seem to be able to do, which is to take their guilt, put it in a box, put the lid on it, and take it out when they feel like taking it out and not obsess on things. I've observed that with the men in my life, and I'm envious.
Well, I sadly have no men in my life, so I can't observe anything about them, although I recall them with fondness. They smelled good. But I think that a little bit, I agree with you absolutely. But sometimes I think the task for us women as we get older, I saw something on Twitter the other day. It said, does a woman become more radical as she gets older? And part of me said, first instinct was yes. But second instinct was that she becomes more herself. You know, just last week I read a column about finding a dog sweltering in a car and calling the police.
Yes.
Now, I made a huge scene. I must tell you, 10 years ago, I might not have called the police. I would have been nervous. I would have been worried. I probably would have hung by the car. But when the police came and the first thing he said, seeing my face, was, miss, don't make a scene. My first thought was, A, I'm not a miss. I haven't been a miss in 85 years. And secondly, you are not going to believe the scene I am going to make if you don't get this dog out of
sure.
this car.
The dog was suffering. I saw that column.
Yeah. Horrible. Mm. Horrible. So anyway.
So the takeaway, aside from the humor of that column, is it's summertime. Yeah, just be extra careful with your pets and your kids.
And for us women, I think, take these negative emotions, try to set them aside in their own box and be sure. more yourself and say what you think and don't edit yourself. Because, damn it, you're right.
How's your garden, Lisa, speaking of summer?
My garden. So, you know what? I won't bore you, but I must tell you that if I could say the one thing in my life that was truly a surprise that would give me pleasure, I mean, I knew my daughter would be a constant, and really she is, and I knew, I have dogs and cats.
The garden and then me.
The garden's pretty damn great. You know, to look at that garden every day and walk around and see bees and butterflies and things turning brown and things that need deadheading and all the things to do part. But for me, that's the lesson too. You just enjoy the good and try to ignore the things to do that the garden presents.
The perennials really pay off, don't they?
Don't
you just love to see them coming up again, knowing you don't have to do a single thing except, you know, chop the stalks down later on?
Is there that it's like it's giving you a present? It's like Christmas morning.
And I have garden envy because I live in New York City now, and so my garden is a basil plant that I'm trying desperately not to let die. That's all that's as big as my garden gets. I go there. Shoot, it's like Longwood Gardens. It's gorgeous.
And you also have pets or pet door.
I have plural pets, which is something I reluctantly I have had a dog that I adored named Pip, and I moved away from Philadelphia with Pip, and she replaced him with four dogs. Now, when I went to college, she got only one corgi. So I don't know what that means, that like my little, her grand dog was a bigger blow when he moved out.
It's like animal math.
But so I've had my dog for 5 years, and I repoed a cat from my mom. My mom has too many animals, and this one cat was getting pestered by the dogs and was too frightened. And so I said I would borrow her after I saw a mouse, and then I just decided I'm keeping her. I'm in love.
And you have, but now you have a small place in New York?
Yes, I have just and a one-bedroom apartment. Okay. The dog and the cat get along great because my dog is well-adjusted, better adjusted than my mom's dogs.
How dare you? How dare you?
And how many animals do you have now? Do you
no, I, I'm, now I want to beg the answer. I don't want to, I'm entering A&E hoarder territory. As long as I'm keeping off cable, I have five dogs and two cats, and I have a pony, and we have a bunch of chickens.
Yeah. And you take care of all of those those guys yourself?
Pretty much. Okay. I mean, I do have some help when we are traveling, which is a problem. You try to get a house sitter for like 15 chickens. It ain't that easy. But look, it's the life I wanted.
Yeah.
And I love it.
What do they do for you, all those animals?
I love it. Well, first, they're nonverbal. I mean, look at me. You can't shut me up, right? And so I don't, although I talk to them too. But I think that a relationship to the animal world in time, it's changed me. I've become a vegetarian. I think I'm more aware of our connectedness across species. Am I sounding too postgraduate here? But I think it makes me a better person to know an animal. I love Temple Grandin's work in that regard.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Whether it's a dog or a cat or a piggy, they're kind of all the same. And I've learned from these chickens how well they know me, that they respond to certain commands, and they're buddies of mine.
Well, so let me ask you, if you're a vegetarian and kind of a native Philadelphia person, what Philadelphia foods have you had to give up?
Well, you know,
cheese with, or did you like that
cheese with? But there's always pasta.
Yeah.
And there's always all sorts of dumb stuff like beans and kale, and you find stuff to eat.
Yeah.
Francesca,
are you a vegetarian too?
I still eat fish because DiNardo's crabs, I need that in my life.
Oh.
So yeah, I still eat fish, but yeah, it's similar. I miss eating meat. I know it tastes great. I'm not going to joke about that, but I just love the animals so much. I love my pets that I feel too guilty.
And where do you shop in New York?
I really love to shop at this little local farmer's market. That has been my new favorite thing because so much of New York is indoors and air-conditioned. And
sure.
So just even though my farmer's market is between two major roads, it feels like a little bit of this green space that I miss so much. So that's plus I can go food shopping with my dog, and I love to do everything with my dog. So farmer's market.
We'll pick up on that in just a little bit on Radio Times. I'd like to kind of look at your transition to New York from the Philadelphia area, how that's working out with you, and we'll talk a little bit more about the book. We've got Lisa Scottolini and her daughter, Francesca Saratella, in studio today. Their new book of humorous essays is Have a Nice Guilt Trip. It is their fifth collaboration, and Lisa, you've got a number of mystery novels. How many? Where are you at right now?
You know what? I'm not really sure. I think it's about 22 or 23. Keep Quiet is the most recent one.
Okay, I've read something like you've had 30 million books in print, and she's all over the place. So anyway, we invite you to join the conversation. It's 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Flashpoint Theater supports WHYY and presents Herringbone now through July 27th, starring 10-time Barrymore nominee Ben Dibble. George Herringbone is a unique kind of vaudeville star with the looks, the voice, and the moves. He also has a little help, which is more than he bargained for. Herringbone is a harrowing musical ghost story that explores the true price of fame. Tickets at flashpointtheater.org and 267-997-3312. Flashpoint Theater proudly supports WHYY.
Most people want their wild violets to vanish. But on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll help someone whose purple posies are being eaten before she can enjoy them and identify the culprit as a creature welcome in any landscape. Plus a primer on proper tree planting and answers to all your growing questions. At You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. As a Native American, Billy Mills endured discrimination and depression, but inspired by his father, he became an Olympic champion.
He said, look deeper and way down deeper where the dreams lie. It's the pursuit of a dream that'll heal broken souls.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain. Lisa Scottolini and daughter Francesca Saratella are here today with their new book of humorous essays called Have a Nice Guilt Trip. It is their fifth collaboration. And as always, you're invited to join the conversation. 1-888-477-9499 is the number to call. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And we do have an email from Denise who says, this reminds me of an interview with Maureen O'Hara, who was asked about her leading men, and she said, I thought this was going to be about me. Another humorous person. Thank you very much for that email, Denise. But leading men, shall we get into that, Francesca?
Sure.
Okay, because everything is on the table here, right?
I'm an open book.
Okay. Speaking of which, in the book,
yes.
You had a boyfriend. And,
I did.
You know, he seemed like a lovely gentleman.
I know. I mean, I've written about dating a lot, but this is the first of these collections that really covers one relationship. And mm-hmm. I'm so glad that it does, because it covers all the happy times. Unfortunately, we did just recently break up, which, look, it happens.
Sure.
I joke that I put him in the acknowledgments, like, 4 days before things went south. And I think it was like getting a name tattooed on your arm. It was a jinx. I jinxed it. Once I put them in print. But no, I'm glad that I did, because of an amicable breakup. And now It's like I have a little retrospective, I guess.
Well, that's the way it rolls. And,
right.
And Lisa, dare I ask, you know,
I remain celibate. Mary, I'm destined
that's
for
that's not what that. I asked, but okay.
Yeah, oh, sorry.
And that's okay if you want to offer that up. But, it, you know, no, I mean, any in the future, do you see yourself? I mean, you lovingly, laughingly, you know, refer to your ex-husbands as thing one and thing two.
Wait, not lovingly.
Okay.
Are you crazy?
but, I mean, are you open to it?
I'm open to it.
Okay.
But I must tell you, I have a great circle of girlfriends. I feel very blessed in this job and
yes.
in the child and in my health. And I think that so many of us, you know what starts to be the problem when you get to be in my age and you sort of have a life? Mm-hmm. I have a house that I own. It's painted just the way I like. Sometimes I look around and I go, what would I change for someone? And I go, sure. He'd have to be pretty terrific.
Yeah.
And also, I think for women who... I think many of us at our ages have accomplished something, mm-hmm. and I'm really not interested in living less of a life to make somebody else feel better. Does it sound too harsh?
No.
Yeah, fair enough.
So it's kind of like, of course I'm open to it.
We'll
but,
see.
Right. In the past, somebody said to me once, you know, you're a handful. And I thought, yeah, why would you want to be with anybody that was less than a handful? Like, anybody with any stuff to them should have a handful.
Sure.
So there you go.
Okay. Back to the phones we go. Bob from Pottstown is on the line. Welcome to Radio Times, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I want to say to Lisa Scottolini and her daughter, I have been a reader of your books for quite a number of years. And I don't think I've read them all, but I'm getting pretty close, I think. And I read them on the audio CD books, and the readers are excellent. I can't tell you how excellent
terrific.
They are. And one thing I do, of course, I like the stories, but the one thing I particularly appreciate is the descriptions of Philadelphia and the surrounding area. Many of these places I would not be able to go to, so I got a real nice description through your books regarding that matter. And thank you again, and I'm looking forward to reading many more books from you.
Well, thanks,
thank
Bob.
You,
thanks
Bob.
So much for the call.
You know, he brings up a good point, because I think that we love audiobooks. In fact, this book was picked by Oprah as one of the four best audiobooks of the summer. Mm-hmm. So we were honored by that. But I think the point that he makes is a good one, because I think whatever you write, you're always anchoring it in the specific. You know, in the novels, I work hard to just flesh out the environment because it supports the characters. Sure. And I think that's true in these essays as well. We're always talking about something specific, whether it's, you know, the day that you find a gray hair on your chin and you realize you're turning into an Amish man before your eyes. Like, you've got to be really narrowly focused for people to relate to it.
And write what you know.
And write what you know, or write what you can figure out, too.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to the next question. What is the writing process like for you? And we'll start with Lisa. I mean, do you sit down in the morning and have a specific place you want to go, or is it really free-flowing? Do you take a million breaks? Do you make yourself sit until you get to a certain point? What do you do?
Well, briefly, I do I'm doing three books a year. I do the Rosado novel that comes out, Betrayed, in November. I do a standalone that comes out in April. I think it's called Every 15 Minutes. And this book, Have a Nice Guilt Trip This Summer. So I'm writing all the time. In short, I have a really easy routine. I do 2,000 words a day. I don't take breaks. Oh, that's not true. I take a break during the day, but however I get to 2,000 words, I'm done at 2,000 words. Sometimes I luck out and I'm done by 6. Other times I'm not done till 11. So, and that's true of these essays as well. I mean, I'm very behavioral about writing. I do it every day, 7 days a week. And if I hit my 2,000 word count, I will produce 2 novels and a collection of funny essays.
Where does the inspiration come from?
Life. I'm lucky. Oh, my God. And I think so many people have such wonderful imaginations that if they believed in themselves, and I still try to believe in myself, but if they just could get out of their own way and set their self-doubt aside and write it down, man, we'd have wonderful, wonderful things to read.
And Francesca?
Yeah, I mean, I was so lucky to have my mom model a writer and a writer's life and work as being like any regular job. She always kept regular hours. She was always disciplined about it. It wasn't as if, oh, she was waiting for some magical muse to tap her on the shoulder. But actually, that made it seem more accessible to me. Like, if I just work hard and put in the time, maybe I could do this too. So I've been working on a novel myself, and my fiction writing habits are very similar to hers, where the word count goal just helps me get out of my own way emotionally about it. But with these funny, you know, trying to write funny is difficult and hard because, you know, humor is spontaneous, but when you're writing it, it feels so practiced. By the end of it, you think, ugh, this is not going to be funny. But then, voila, it is. I think for these stories, I just try to think, what was that story I told over dinner with my girlfriends? Because I always want to make my girlfriends laugh, and they make me laugh harder than any comedian that I could ever imagine. I mean, girlfriends are funny. Sure. So when I think, what story did I think was worthy of telling them over drinks, that's the story that's worthy of getting written in for these column books.
And so, Lisa, humor, harder or easier than mystery?
Well, I love it. I find it, how can I say it? I think it's easier because for me, I love to joke around and laugh so much that in these dramatic novels I write, I have to stop joking around. You know, I imbue the characters with wit. And I regard that as a hallmark, frankly, of really smart women. You know, they're funny. You're funny. Your producer, Susan, she's funny. And if you get in any ladies' room, you're going to leave that ladies' room laughing if you just have some conversations and are open to it, as I am. So for me, with the other books, I have to actually dial it back and say, this is not the time when you get to really let this rip. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, I find it almost easier because it's more natural to me.
We've got a tweet from Jordan. What inspired you to write this book? And I guess we're talking about Have a Nice Guilt Trip.
For me, we've been writing these because I think it's really the journey of mothers and daughters. These books have been compared to Irma Bombeck, and I'm very honored by that comparison. And that's why they started. They started because we wanted to really celebrate domestic life, that we talk about, you know, family and mattering so much. There's precious little of it in the culture that's positive, but a positive image in a way that is not sanitized or kind of BS-y. That's what inspired us.
Francesca?
Yeah, I mean, I think so many of my friends now are really close to their moms, where they would say that their mom's their best friend, but that it's a different kind of best friend, and that it doesn't mean there's no moments of friction. So we wanted to just put that out there and share it, because I think a lot of people can relate to it, and the way that our relationship has had to evolve. I think maybe once or twice already on this interview, she's called me her kid or her child. It's still hard for her to think of me that I'm 28 years old. I'm a real person now, but our relationship is evolving into being two adult women, and that brings with that some challenges, but also some really new, awesome pleasures.
So,
And I was just going to say, I think that is true. And there isn't in the ether a lot of stuff examining the mother-daughter or mother-child relationship, forgive me, as that child is an adult. And yet those relationships are still seminal in our lives, sure, and central to them. And we still negotiate them. That is always evolving. And I sort of like throwing a spotlight on it.
So what was your relationship like when, Francesca, you were 17?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, it was, I admit, I had the usual teenager-y things, whereas I didn't miss a chance to guilt her. Should ever I get to be right, I wanted to be like, Mom, remember I was right. But I wasn't too bad. She didn't have it too hard.
No, I actually didn't. Yeah. We always joke that, you know, people say, was she rebellious? Honestly, she wasn't rebellious. Because, not to take credit for her good behavior, but the truth is, I'm not a control freak. So I was like, hey, you. And also, I think we had a very unique situation, mm-hmm, as a single mother and an only child. I remember when she was little, when she turned to me, she said, if I'm an only child, does that mean you're an only mom? I said, yeah, it kind of does. But so in a way, not that we're, I was always a parent, but I think watching her grow up and watching her come into her own, find her own voice, not only in print, but in life. It's what every parent goes through, every mom and dad too, and you're lucky, you're blessed if you have that experience.
Francesca, did you think, did you have any thoughts of other careers before you turned to writing?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I thought maybe I'd want to be a veterinarian because I loved animals so much. Then I realized I'd have to put some of them down, and that sounded really miserable. But yeah, it became clear that writing was a passion of my own, and my mom never, ever pressured me, which is probably why I didn't feel the need to rebel against those wishes of mine. And I'm so glad that she did and let me develop my own voice and figure it out for myself.
I'd have to add, as a proud mother and co-author, that she went to Harvard and won every writing prize there was, including the Hoops Prize. I mean, so, you know.
So the collaboration process, how does that work with you two?
Right. Well, we write them across state lines, which is the safest way to work with your mother if you must do so. I write mine in New York. She writes hers here in Philadelphia. And then we put them together. And I joke that we probably would fight if we were actually collaborating on each and every story in that book. But the truth is, I've recognized the fact that I can find a lot of editors, a lot of critics. You only get one mother, and I have a great one. And honestly, she's probably too soft on me anyway.
Does she edit your work?
No, she doesn't. I keep her as that mom. I keep her in that cheerleader mom role.
And so you don't look at her essays and say, do you ever say, oh, you
talk
to maybe
about
phrase
them.
That a little bit differently? And
look at her. I can't. What am I going to do? I'm fight her for it. It's not worth the trouble. You know what I mean? She's a strong-willed person. We both are. So we don't edit each other that much, but we do talk about the process. We talk about ideas. We bounce stuff off each other.
It's a funny thing because not everything is we think of it as essay worthy, but when we get together at the end, then we put these essays together, or when she sends them into the newspaper, then I see what she's writing about. And in one of the collections, she had written about how she reads the New York Times wedding announcements and sort of says, well, that person got married at 30, so I have two more years.
It's so depressing. Like, I consider myself a feminist. I'm raised by the strong woman. And then I'm like this Jane Austen novel reject in 2014. It was embarrassing. So I sort of busted myself on that.
And then I wrote an essay about how I read the obituaries. And
which is
I
even
see
crazier.
The age. And I see and we hadn't collaborated. I mean, we didn't even know that until we put them together in a book. And I was, well, that's just about the size of it, isn't it?
Have you ever read anything that the other has written and you said no? Why?
Oh,
is
God.
That out there
all the time? I always want to, I want to protect her constantly. I'm always like, Mom, you don't have to get that real.
You
don't
protect me from myself, right?
Exactly. Yes, I'm always like wanting to just take the bullet for her and be like, no, don't write about a gray chin hair. You don't have to do that. You can just say a regular chin hair. That's enough. It doesn't have to be gray.
I can tell you when it was too. Okay. When at my last book tour, you know, you're out there for 10 days, maybe 2 weeks. And how many clothes do I have? None. I had my nice jeans and I changed the jackets. And frankly, I got a little diaper rash.
I wasn't even going to use that example in this interview because I want it to just go away and die. I want this story to just never
be out there. I was in Houston trying to buy, it was called Boudreaux's butt paste, which I bought. They actually sent me some later.
Which is even worse, right? It's called butt paste.
He was like, please don't write this. I said, honey, I have to write it. If it is not making me cringe, it's not good enough. And
that is a lesson she's taught me. And it's never that I think it embarrasses me. I always just worry it will embarrass her.
I never feel that for her, though. I think she writes about the most emotional things. She wrote about my mother's passing. And she was actually in this collection, wrote about, you know, it's the first part of when we started to observe changes in my mother and think, wow, something might be wrong. And it's an enormously heartfelt essay. The reviews of this book have been wonderful. They've mentioned that essay. When I saw it, I said, you know, well done. Bravo. Yeah.
You know what I loved, and I don't know that it's in this book, but yeah. In one of your Sunday columns, you talk about Mother Mary and the fact that she loved to have her nails done.
Mm, yes.
And you helped her with that. I just thought that was kind of a break from the... Well, there was humor in it, if I remember correctly,
right.
But it was really very sweet.
Thank you.
That's special to have a very close relationship with your
grandmother. I feel so lucky and blessed to have had that relationship with her because she was an incredible woman. I mean, I feel like I was raised by two really strong women. And that essay that you're referring to is one of the hardest ones I ever had to write because I had to write that one just 2 days after she had passed. Mm. And it was remembering a little tradition that we always have, but one that I did while she was in hospice care, and I did her nails for her. And that was an essay that was impossible to feel like it was an adequate tribute. It was just impossible to feel like it was enough or good enough, and I didn't turn it in feeling satisfied with it, but I knew that I couldn't.
Sure.
And that was one of those moments where being a writer, I think of myself as a storyteller, but sometimes you do just have to make a record of something.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, and my mom said, you know, we can just run nothing this week. You don't have to run something. I said, you know what? As much as I don't want to write this right now, I wish I weren't telling this story.
Sure.
I didn't want to pass up that opportunity to just remember her in that moment and in print. So it was really special.
It was a lovely tribute.
Lovely.
Oh,
thank
it really
you.
Was.
Thanks.
So, Lisa,
I want to add something about that, too, because I thought that what I loved so much about that essay is that I think Francesca did have a very close relationship to my mother, and because my mother took care of her while I went back to work to try to get to earn money. And I think while we all talk about how wonderful it is to be a grandparent, and it sounds amazing, what I loved about Francesca's essay and the essays about Mother Mary are that they remind us that your grandchildren love you, that you mustn't ever underestimate how important you are in that person's life, because she got so much. She just adored my mother. And I like to hear it from the grandchild's point of view. And unless the grandchild picks up a pen, nobody knows that.
Sure. Where does your brother Frank fit into the picture?
Well, he's living in Miami, and he's mm-hmm. a wonderful guy, and he really he lived with my mother towards the end, and
yeah.
so he is, you know, we love him, we're in touch, of course. He's
yeah.
very sad. He's having, it's hard.
Yeah, because she was with him, and then all right. of a sudden you're by yourself in the same house, and what is he doing?
They both came up for hospice, so they were both okay. at our house for all during that time, and we're a close family, so we will always be there for each other.
Does he write?
No, he has a normal job. He manages a restaurant, and he loves it down in Miami, and he loves that. And he's coping as best he can with yeah. the loss of someone who was so important to all of us.
Now, does he figure at all in your writings, or do you kind of let Frank be?
I know. We try to spare some
family
members.
We do.
And as a result, people are very curious about him.
I know.
You know, and it was interesting because my brother is gay, and we always were very honest about that, as we are in a family. We're fine with this. And it was interesting to see the reaction change over time, because I said, listen, Frank, if we'll talk about you, do you mind if we reveal that?
Sure.
And he said, no, I'm fine with it. And I must tell you that the email in the beginning about him in that regard was not overly friendly.
Hmm.
But it has changed in time, as we all of us have changed in this world. And so I think in the beginning we were protecting his privacy a little, and now we are... the email about him is very supportive, and he deserves it.
Okay, we're up against a break, so we're going to take that short break. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawane. Lisa Scottolini and daughter Francesca Saratella are here today in studio. Their new book of humorous essays is Have a Nice Guilt Trip, and our phone lines are open, 1-888-477-9499. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Be right back.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi, the host of Q. Tune into Q each day for your dose of arts, culture, and entertainment, from live music and feature chats with compelling cultural figures to debates on the issues of the day. Q has got you covered. That's coming up from PRI, Public Radio International. Weeknights at 9, beginning August 4th on WHYY.
Z- Soul singer Bobby Womack died 2 weeks ago at age 70. On the next Fresh Air, a 1999 interview with him. He was discovered by Sam Cooke, who first recorded him. Womack's hits include the theme from Across 110th Street, Looking for a Love, which was covered by the Jay Giles Band, and It's All Over Now, which was covered by the Rolling Stones and became their first international hit. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The host country, now a footnote, tries to learn from its history.
We have to extract from the tragedy. We have to reformulate everything. Brazil shall be Brazil again in soccer.
More soccer left in the World Cup, but maybe Brazil stands to gain the most national wisdom from the 2014 tournament. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain today. Authors Lisa Scottolini and Francesca Saratella are here. They're our guests. They're back on Radio Times. Mother and Daughter, their newest book, is called Have a Nice Guilt Trip. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we invite you to give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. So, Lisa, you like to write about middle age and walking through middle age and dealing with middle age. At the end of the day, it's not that bad, is it?
No, we're alive, my God.
Okay.
Setting the bar high.
But, is it time to accept our perceived flaws? I mean, really accept them? Well, and are they flaws?
I think, no, of course not. Mary, come on. I actually feel that, here's where you find out that I'm a complete narcissist, that the problem is sort of the outside world.
Yes.
I mean, as you get older, as a woman in particular, you start to feel how very marginalized you become. Mm-hmm. And it's not only in something like sexual attractiveness, because honestly, that's the least of our problems. It's really more like sexism in the world at large. You know,
yes.
You kind of like, gee, can you get to this level in book sales?
Right.
Can you get this review as a book written by women? Books written by women are reviewed with much less frequency, as we all know. Mm-hmm. And so you start to be a little crankier. I always feel that we have so much to offer in midlife. Men and women as well,
sure.
But that we are not appreciated for that. And I think also that midlife is its own journey, and that's why I take the time to write about it. Whether it's the smaller things like, wow, I'm driving around at night with my daughter coming back from the Nantucket Book Festival where we spoke about 2 weeks ago, and all of a sudden I can't see a damn thing driving at night. Uh-huh. Like I'm in Connecticut driving through the cattle chute feeling that I might as well be at Dorney Park on some kind of roller coaster. It was scary.
Sure.
Or just like bunion surgery. All the changes in your body, and then you're dealing with the fact that you're becoming more invisible in the world at large.
Yes.
And that's unfortunate. So that I sort of want to keep us in focus, because I think women have so much to offer. And as we get older, you know, we're stronger, we're smarter, we have a better sense of humor, and we start to understand, and I'll shut up in a minute about this, that the things we worried about when we were younger really don't matter at all.
Yes, yes.
Namely, how you look.
You hear that, Francesca?
I do have a great model in her, although it's true, you share your vulnerabilities with everyone in print, but you hardly share them with me, because that drive that she's talking about when she said she couldn't see, she would not admit to me that she couldn't see. She was just claiming that driving 40 to 45 miles an hour on I-95 is normal and safe for people who want to live. She goes, I'm sorry, I'm not going to kill us, because she would not let me drive. I mean, it was this huge battle of her letting me drive. I had to eke out of her that she could actually not see. I said, Ma, if you can't see, you should definitely let me drive.
Well, I didn't realize I couldn't see. You know, it was like in sixth grade when I got glasses. You know, I was like, wow, there's a chalkboard up there. Do they still have that? And I didn't know I couldn't see. I just knew that I was, well, at the moment, I was hating I-95. You know?
Oh, yeah.
You know, between the orange cones and through Connecticut, I was like, this is really bad. And we actually pulled over to Chuck's Top to have, like, a fight right by the Slim Jims. We were duking it out. And it was interesting because, you know, Francesca, living in New York City, doesn't drive a lot. And she was like, let me drive. And I'm like, let's just pull over to Ramada or something dumb like that. Let's just do it.
It was 10 p.m. I was like, we are not pulling over in a Ramada at 10 when we can
right,
get
home. Right, but to hear what she said, it was 10 p.m. Now, you say to a person who's almost 60, it was 10. I'm like, it's sleepy time, nappy nappy for mommy. And she's like, it's only 10 o'clock. If we bust it, we can get to Manhattan by 1. And I'm like, Oh, my God.
Yeah, there's the difference.
Right. Exactly. But, you know, you are not worth the money if you cannot see the metaphoric value of your daughter saying to you at a truck stop in Connecticut, "Mom, let me take the wheel." And me going, you know what? There's more here than about
the
driving.
The roles are reversing.
Exactly.
Yes.
Time to let it roll.
All right. On that note, time to get to the telephones. Marlene from Langhorne is on the air with us. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. How are you?
Well. You're on with Lisa and Francesca.
I can't believe I'm speaking to my favorite author. Oh my God.
How exciting. Thank you, Marlene. We're glad you called.
Well, I wanted to tell you, I mean, I love your books. My girlfriends all love your books. Every time a new one comes out, we go crazy getting to the book. But we are disappointed by one thing.
What, honey bun?
You don't come out to Bucks County to sign.
No, that's
an
outrage.
We want to meet you and have you sign our books. And every time, I notice in the paper, you don't come out here. And we do have a lot of big bookstores here.
I have to put that on the list.
You email me at lisa@scottolini.com. Tell me where to go, and I will go there for Betrayed in November.
Okay, that will be wonderful.
I would love to do it, Marlene.
I also have to tell you, my husband never reads any of the books that I read, but when he read the first one of your books, oh my God, I have to fight him. Who reads it first, me or him?
Really?
Now, he loves everything. He loves everything about it because you referred to Philadelphia, and it just, you know, makes it feel like you're part of the family kind of thing.
Thanks, Marlene, so much for the telephone
call.
That's
lovely.
And, you know, I wanted to point out, the impression is that you guys have a real huge female audience, maybe not so many men, but we've had, this is the second male reference we've had here this hour, so they're out there.
I must tell you.
They are.
Of the novels, most of my readers are men. There's no doubt about that.
The mystery.
They've sort of done research on that. But these books, I think we get a significant male following because we get email every week from, first line's always the same. I'm a guy, but I read chick wit. I think the point is this stuff is not for women. It tends to be about women. Most men are interested in women. I'm interested in men. I've been reading stories about men my whole life.
Sure.
So, and I think sometimes there'll be a funny email that will say, I read chick wit or I read these books to see how women think, which is very scary to think that we're representing all of us with ovaries. So hold tight, ladies.
All right, we've got another call. Charlotte from Doylestown, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Lisa. Hi, Francesca.
Hi.
I wanted to say, hi. Lisa, I am your contemporary, and I love chick wit. But something that's been on my mind a lot lately, and I'm wondering if it's affecting your thoughts, is we grew up in an age where we saw tremendous advances with women's rights. And now I feel like with all these changes in reproductive health issues, for example, the recent ruling from the Supreme Court based on Hobby Lobby, that we're going backwards. And we're of a generation where we fought for these rights, and we don't have them as much anymore. And I just want to get your feedback on that.
Well, I think the lesson for us women is to, it's sort of what I said before, say what you want, ask for what you want, say what you think, use your power, whatever your political view is, to vote. Make people aware, you know, in other words, it is our task that even though people want to sort of set us aside or marginalize us, that we not let that happen. We cannot be willing victims. So I never blame anyone else. I'm just going to go, you know what, I'll always say what I think. I'll always vote for who I think will promote things that I care about. And we just have to always do that. I mean, sisterhood is still powerful. If we women realize the political power we have and the market power we have, and we collected it and organized it, man, oh man, there'd be no stopping us.
You know what? The two words I have a real hard time with around election time are voter apathy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Francesca, what are your thoughts on
that? I mean, I think the really important thing is that women my age, I'm 28, women in their 20s realize that it's the work is not done. It's not over. We haven't, great, we're equal now. Ta-da. Thanks, Mom. You know, the generation above us made enormous, huge strides that women my age should be grateful for, but it wasn't, there's still much left to do. So I'm certainly try to stay plugged in. I vote in local elections, which is really where you have the most power as a voter, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And just to stay involved and to stand up for yourself, not be afraid to say, I'm a feminist. That means you want equal rights. If we're afraid to say that, we're in a bad way. That can't be some sort of man-bashing, unsexy thing to say. I don't want to date anybody who doesn't want to date a feminist.
All right. Lines are open, 888-477-9499. We're on with Lisa Scottolini and Francesca Saratella. Their new book is called Have a Nice Guilt Trip. And Lisa, there's this chapter called In Which I Officially Hit the Wall. And in reading this, I did have an urge to throw the Urban Dictionary against the wall. You can talk about it better than I. You're turning 57 in this chapter.
Right.
And you discover some new thoughts about turning 57.
Well, I think it said something about, first you start to notice, I think, a little bit that in magazines they'll go like, sexy at any age. And then they'll show you sexy at 30, sexy at 40, sexy at 49. Wait a minute, am I still sexy? Oh, I think I'm sexy because fleece pants are so sexy. And I think the hitting the wall thing came when I was like, wow, I think at some point you officially hit the wall. I think the age. So I looked up, what does this expression mean? And in the Urban Dictionary, it said, the point at which women who used to be hot aren't anymore. Example, Heather Locklear. It's like, this is the funniest
thing. That's terrible.
It is terrible.
But women get crazy about age at every single age. I mean, I'm 28, and I, like I said, sadly, just broke up with my boyfriend of 2 years, which is a sad thing, but I'm okay with it. That's fine. I had a girlfriend of mine say to me, wow, that's so brave of you that you're willing to start over. I was like, start over? Like, what are we talking about, girls? We're losing our minds. I mean, you have to find yourself, discover yourself. Sexy is how you feel. I mean, yeah. We're not products. We have to stop thinking of ourselves as products, as women. There was a friend of mine's boyfriend was telling me about, my strategy going into the dating scene again. He goes, well, you have to know your market value. And I said, for God's sakes, I don't have a market. I'm a human being.
That's not, overthinking it a bit.
Right? I mean, but I think we slip into thinking of ourselves like that, even with this crazy, let me take a selfie. You know, the selfie's like, how can I market myself in social media because I'm something to be consumed? We gotta have more depth than that, and we have to embrace that depth.
So your attitude toward dating is essentially just to see what comes along and just live your life in the meantime?
I mean, look, I think sometimes with my mom is so open about having, you know, a couple divorces under her belt and being, might think I'm cynical about marriage. I'm not. I just take it really seriously, and I take dating seriously, and I know that it's not going to follow any timeline. I want to get it right. So I'm happy. I'm enjoying it, and I'm enjoying my life in the city and meeting new people, and we'll see what happens.
How did you adjust to life in New York City? It's so different from Philadelphia.
It is
it's
different.
Wonderful in its own ways. It's for me, I'm kind of a Philly gal. It's a
right.
big town, and there's a lot to it, and a little intimidating?
It was, sure, but I think I had sheer will. I just had it in my head as a little girl that I always wanted to live in New York City for some period of time. I love Philly. I still love Philly, and believe me, in New York, you're never a New Yorker unless you have, like, three generations who've been living there forever, so I'm still a Philadelphian, but I always wanted to try my hand there, and especially as a writer, it is an isolated job. So for me at my age, I love that I can work by myself all day and then step outside and be in the busiest, you know, most fun, most exciting place on earth. So for me, it's perfect balance.
You tell a fun story about your encounter with a cabbie on a cold winter's night.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, the thing about New York is that no matter how much of the resource, there's more people than can have it in one time. And cabs are always like that. It was a freezing night, 3 a.m. in a cab. My friend and I finally got a cab. We get in. When we tell him where they're going, he says, oh, no, you have to get out. I leave. And for some reason...
Wait, he kicked you out?
He kicked me out, which is actually illegal, I've been told. So I should have just put my foot down. But, you know, do you really want to be trapped in a car with a guy who's angry at you? No.
So my
husband said, no, I'm not. Get out of the car. So I get out of the car. Suddenly, I'm walking away. He jumps out and starts yelling at me, you slammed my door. Why you gotta slam my door? Why can't you be a lady? And I just went instantly to Philly. I mean, this is the Philly bread in me. I went to instant yelling right back at him. I said, slam your door because you're going to break it. I said, I couldn't break your door if I tried. I'm a 115-pound woman. Now, let me tell you, it takes a presence of mind to lie about your weight while yelling at a complete stranger in the middle of the night. But, you know, I did it, and I wasn't going to take any crap from him. So I feel like Philly raised me
to live out
in New York. Absolutely.
All right. You also mentioned, this is back to Mother Mary, there's a lot to this, her character. She was a songwriter in her youth.
She was.
She passed at, what was it, 90?
Yes.
She's 90. So, what was she writing?
She had written many beautiful ballads. And
she was published?
And she played by ear. I mean, she
taught herself piano.
This was before the kids came along, but when we were growing up, she played us that music.
And she did have some moment in her youth when a song was legitimately stolen by a multiple Tony Award-winning musical. And it was so bad that when she sued them, they offered to settle. So it must have been fairly legitimate, the plagiarism case. Of course, Mother Mary does not settle easily, so she rejected that offer.
Really?
But,
So it wasn't a good amount of
and
money.
And she never got her day in court. I mean, they never even followed up with it because that was too difficult. So yeah. It was a real shame. But then, last year, sort of in a weird memory of that, she thought that Stevie Wonder had stolen one of her songs as well. And she calls me on the phone. She goes, I need to sue Stevie Wonder. Can I, can I speak to your boyfriend with that I was a musician? You know, I need to speak to him because he'll know how to, like, my boyfriend knows how to sue Stevie Wonder. I don't know where she was coming with that.
Right, but we should make clear, Stevie Wonder did not steal
my grandmother's song.
Okay, so yeah, like real heir. We have to be good.
As if that needs to be clarified.
But only my mother would, go against a beloved American icon,
You know, things happen.
Exactly.
So. Now, you'd mentioned earlier, Lisa, because we're kind of coming up to the top of the hour, you're in the midst of another work. You've got something else coming. What was it, coming out in the fall?
I am. The Rosato and Associates series, which is set in Philadelphia, and it's a series about all-women law firm.
And you are a lawyer, right?
I am. Okay. I am in my former life, yes. And so that's called Betrayed, and that's coming out November 25th or so.
And is that a mystery?
Yes. One of the reviews said those books are a crime story with a family subplot, and the book in April is a family story with a crime subplot. And I was like, well, how reviewy of you, but I'll take it.
So when you write a mystery, do you start from the back and write the end and write backwards?
I mean, my God. It's much too orderly. No, I have an idea. Like, the idea is whatever the idea is, and then go. I don't have any outline. I don't know. And, people say, do you know how it ends? I don't know how it middles. These essays are the same way.
Well, how do you come up with the twists and turns?
You just try to think of what, every day you go, what would logically happen next? What would these characters actually do next? And they lead you to it. I mean, in a funny way. Unfortunately, they don't really write it for you, but you get to keep the money, so it works out.
All right. Lisa Scottolini, Francesca Saratella, thank you so much for stopping by. It was a real pleasure. A lot of fun. Their new book is called Have a Nice Guilt Trip. And remember, you can head to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including our Facebook page and podcasts. Adam Staniszewski is our engineer today. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. And we had help this week from Emily Haas and Ariel Plotnick. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Thanks for joining us.